and welcome to the Teach Suzuki podcast. I'm Paula Bird, and I invite you to spend the next few minutes with me talking about something that may change our world, one child, one family, and one community at a time. Hello, and welcome to the fourth episode of the Teach Suzuki podcast. In this podcast episode, I want to talk about what I want my Studio Suzuki parents to know. As this is a large subject, I can only touch on the basic outlines here. I'll flesh out the material with my parents over a series of classes, and so I will also offer up my ideas over the course of several later podcasts that will touch on these subjects. But for now, though, here are 10 things that I think a Suzuki parent should know. The first thing that I want my studio parents to know is what the Suzuki method is, its basic features, and how it works in theory. And this was the subject of my first two podcast episodes. I went over the subject area in great detail and depth because I do believe it's important that the parent share the philosophical beliefs that I, the Suzuki teacher, hold in order for both of us to be working well together for the student's benefit. Because this method was created to fit into a Japanese culture, some parents may not immediately understand the power of the Suzuki method philosophy. So I think it's important that I spend some time with new parents so that I can help them to start the Suzuki journey on the right foot, on the most successful pathway. So briefly, I'll summarize those basic features and components of the Suzuki method. They are parent involvement, early beginning, listening, repetition, encouragement, learning with other children, graded repertoire, and delayed reading. And I talked about these basic features at a very great length and the ramifications of these important features when I did my first podcast episode. So if you want to hear that again or for the first time, you can just go visit episode one. The second thing I want my studio parents to know is the six foundational Suzuki philosophy points that I talked about in episode two. These 6 points are extremely important for parents to understand because parents will completely alter their behavior at home in general when they understand the ramifications and the power that parents really have to affect their child's environment. These six foundational principles are: talent is not inborn. All children have talent. Every child improves depending on his parents because parents are the child's most important teacher. Man is the son of his environment and parents are their child's most influential role models. Creating desire to learn in the child is the parent's duty because parents have the biggest influence and opportunity to influence their child. And finally, the Suzuki experience is about developing the whole child and not just about developing child artists. The third thing I want my parents to understand is what the Suzuki triangle is. The Suzuki triangle is something we talk about a lot in the Suzuki world. The triangle has 3 points, and each point represents an important part of the Suzuki relationship. 1 point represents the teacher. There must be a good teacher in this learning relationship because without a good teacher, very few good things are going to come about otherwise. The teacher is responsible for training the parent to be an effective home teacher to the child. The teacher also teaches the child how to play the instrument with a beautiful sound, correct technique, and expressive interpretation. Although that's just one sentence to express the gist of what a teacher teaches a child, believe me, it's quite a lot of stuff that teachers do. I myself have studied how to play my instrument for almost 50 years. Not only did I study as a young child through secondary schools and private teachers, but I went on to achieve advanced educational degrees in performance of my instrument. And also, I've taken many instructional courses related to the Suzuki repertoire so that I would be an even more effective teacher and performer. Most teachers embark on a similar journey. So when I say that the teacher is responsible for teaching the child how to play the instrument with a beautiful sound, correct technique, and expressive interpretation, I am saying that the teacher will be doing quite a lot of work because teaching these things is a lot of work. There is so much to learn. The second part of the triangle represents the parent. The parent is responsible for several things, and because this podcast is aimed at Suzuki parents primarily, I will set out in detail what I think the specific parent responsibilities are. I think parents are responsible for daily practice with the child, creating the proper learning environment at home so that the child experiences successful learning, playing the recordings for the child as the teacher expects, helping the child to learn and memorize a piece. But don't worry, the teacher will offer you many ideas to help you learn the piece and teach it to your child. And finally, I think parents are responsible for helping the child to master the fingerings and bowings as the teacher asks. The third part of the Suzuki triangle represents the child. And the child just has one tiny responsibility, and that is to be a child. Yep, that's it. Just let the child be a child. Don't expect the child to do anything grown up, just to be a child. Do childish things and experience the world of music as children do, with wonder, curiosity, and interest. Number four of my top 10 list of things that I want my studio parents to know is the importance of daily listening. I talked at great length about listening in podcast episode 3, and in that episode, I stressed the reasons why I think it's important to consider what types of music we listen to and how often we listen. I also gave suggestions for incorporating more listening into the daily routine. Children need to be immersed in an environment that's filled with music that they will learn and study so that natural learning can occur. And episode 3 talks about how to do that. Because this listening requirement is so very important, I find that I need to remind parents rather frequently about keeping up their end of the bargain by playing the recordings consistently, regularly, and often. And I try to make it clear that I expect the parents to assume this responsibility, not the child. Remember what I said earlier about the Suzuki triangle and the child only being responsible for being a child? Well, this is one of those times when I bring that up, because I often find that parents are quick to pawn off this responsibility on the child instead. Of course, it's easy to do that. It is less work for the parent to do that. But I don't know very many children who willingly or voluntarily seek to play their music regularly. Gosh, most children don't remember to do any really important things by themselves. And that's what growing up is all about. Children need reminders, and so I find that parents also need reminders about playing the music for their children daily. And I don't want you to think I don't understand or appreciate how hard it is to be a parent, because you can bet that I do. I am amazed that parents stay awake by the end of a day. So much is happening when a child grows up, and it amazes me that parents can hold all of this together. In an earlier podcast episode, I said my job as the teacher who sees the parent and child once a week was to focus the parent's lens on the child. I try to help parents stay grounded and focused on the child as much as they can, as the most important thing in the child's lives. It's a hard job to be a parent, I understand that, but the results are completely worth it. The fifth thing I want my Suzuki parents to know and understand is that they need to do daily practice with their child. I'm surprised sometimes that parents may not realize the importance of daily practice. If anyone is ever to achieve any degree of mastery and skill or ability, I would expect that person to be working regularly and often at their skill and ability. One does not become an Olympic athlete just by waking up one day and deciding to be one. It takes repeated effort and drill, and so does learning how to play an instrument. I also try to draw analogies between daily practice and the later expectations that the parents will have regarding the child's doing school homework. I've been known to ask a parent if they will expect their children to do their homework each night, or will they be making excuses for why their child should be excused from homework. Of course, most parents will insist that the child is going to do his or her homework. And yet, there are parents who sometimes do not make the connection that the parent can be teaching the child about daily homework now. Every time a parent comes to lessons and tells me they didn't get to practice because there was something more interesting on TV or some other excuse, I wonder to myself whether that parent will find it easy or hard to get their child to do homework when the child's older. If the child does not role model this behavior now while the child can observe and learn, what lesson exactly is the child to learn for later? So I've talked to my parents over the years about this subject repeatedly. Most parents who struggled once upon a time have told me that what works the best for them is to find the right time of the day that works for both parent and child, to then set up a practice schedule that takes advantage of this right time of the day, and then follow through with a daily practice plan consistently and regularly. And even better is a plan that will include something for contingencies like weekends or special occasions. I always say it's often better to do a little bit rather than skip. Skipping one day leads to 2 days. And ask anyone who's ever tried to stay consistent on a diet, and you'll understand the power of doing it every day. The sixth thing that I want my Suzuki parents to understand is about personalities. I like my parents to know and understand what personality traits and learning styles the parent and the child have. I know what my style is, and I understand my strengths and weaknesses. I also understand how to work with my preferred learning style, although I'm always striving to strengthen all of my learning styles. I want my parents to understand what their dominant personality styles are and how they relate to those of the child. Do my studio parents tend to be quieter, more introspective, and watchful in style, or are they more outgoing and bold? How do they interweave their personality styles with those that the child has? I have enjoyed reading many of the personality books by Florence Littauer. In particular, I found one of her books very helpful for parents to understand the most effective manner in which to work together in home practices. The book is called Personality Plus for Parents: Understanding What Makes Your Child Tick. This book sets out the 4 main personality styles and something which was identified by Hippocrates centuries ago. My parents and I usually embark on figuring out which style the parent most likely favors, and then we figure out what style the child might lean towards. Depending on our answers, we can figure out how we might address any questions that arise later during lessons or home practices. Sometimes merely understanding how another person feels comfortable will go a long way to helping us make more pleasant home practices. I think this would be a great topic, though, for another podcast in the future, because we have a lot of fun considering our personalities and how they impact on each other. The 7th top 10 thing that I want my studio parents to do or know is to recognize what parenting style they tend to favor, and then we work to improve on that if possible or necessary. Many times, parents tell me that when they're having practice problems at home, we can then trace the problem to the kind of parenting style that's happening in the home. Because sometimes the parent is sending silent messages that may be contributing to the problems that the parent's experiencing at home. And whatever the problems are, though, in most cases, the problems can really often be traced back to a parenting style that's being used in the home. And that can come back and be related to a historical thing. It may be the way that the parent themselves were raised. So this always brings up very interesting discussions when we bring up this topic. I will talk about parenting style in a great deal more depth in a future podcast episode, but let me basically say here and now that many parents confuse the encouraging and nurturing aspect of the Suzuki method as advocating for a more permissive parenting style. And that's really quite far from the truth. Dr. Suzuki was a very kind man and generous, but he was reputed to be very firm in his expectations. That didn't sound to me at all like a case for permissive parenting. Parenting styles can be permissive, like where anything tends to be permitted, or the parent has difficulty saying no. This is generally the parenting style that places the least amount of limits on a child's behavior. Unfortunately, this style also teaches the child to be very dependent and does not generally lead to the child's successful self-management and problem solving. Instead, the child often learns that the world centers around him or her, and this belief will definitely clash with others when the child is growing up. The opposite of the permissive parenting style is the dictatorial parenting style, in which the parent uses lots of discipline and force to control things, but the discipline is not often tempered with warmth. The child may become quite rebellious down the road as a result, and many times in lessons I find this child doesn't engage very well in lessons because the parent is providing all of the answers. Then there's the parenting style that provides limits but allows freedom within those limits, and that style I call authoritative. This is the perfect style for parenting, but it's a tricky thing to achieve. I don't think I've met anyone who's perfect at this style without a lot of self-reflection and conscious effort. I certainly hope my studio parents make this style of parenting their goal. When my studio parents and I talk about parenting styles, we focus on which activities are natural for parents to be in charge of. I call these parent-driven activities. And health and safety rules come to mind. Hold my hand when you cross the street. Eat your vegetables. Brush your teeth. Take a bath. I think these sorts of things are perfect for parents to be completely in charge of. But there are other activities I call child-driven, and these are the activities that the child should be entirely in control of. And by control, I mean the parents already decided what time the child's going to be doing these things. But then when they do, the child's in charge of how they do these activities. And that would be like coloring in a coloring book, playing with dolls or toys, and so forth. I wouldn't expect a parent to be telling the child how to color the picture in the coloring book or what game to play with the child's toys. The child would be entirely in charge of that. And the middle of the road is the parent-driven, child-centered activities. And this is where the Suzuki journey would fall. The parent decides certain things, such as like when to practice and what things are going to be practiced. Maybe not the order, however, because the child could do that, but the parent could decide the things that need to be done based on what the lesson requirements were. The child, though, is going to be at the center of the activity in this type of parenting style, and the parent would then pay close attention to how the child is doing. Is the child tired or losing focus? Then we would cut the practice short. Is the child doing the best that he or she can? Then we wouldn't be pushing the child to do something that they could not. This discussion about parenting is a really big one because it has so much to do with how the child will face and handle difficulties in later life. So I think it's a good idea for my studio parents to begin thinking about these sorts of things now while it's still early in the game. The eighth top thing that I want my Suzuki parents to know is how to practice at home and the importance of daily practice. And here are four important things that I put in this category of knowing how to help the child at home. My first thing is I ask them to practice on a regular schedule and every day, no matter what. I will certainly spend some time in future episodes talking about this thorny issue because I think it's probably one of the hardest things for parents and students to grasp and assimilate. Play the recordings daily of the pieces that the child's studying and learning, and also play the recordings for those pieces that the child has already learned, as well as pieces that they will study in the future. A third thing is I ask my parents to incorporate review of material that has already been learned into their daily practices. This is often a neglected area, and yet it may be the most powerful area. Young children don't always remember things easily without a lot of repetition. Oh, gosh, most adults have this problem, too. I remember there was one Suzuki teacher who was, I think her name was Laurie Scott, and she was, one of her parents was saying, "I don't get it. How come my kid doesn't seem to remember this? He remembered it fine at home, but he doesn't remember it at his lesson." And Laurie just shrugged, and she said, "He's seven." And I thought, yep, that's the answer. I find as a Suzuki teacher, there are occasions when even I need to review the Suzuki material. For example, perhaps I have a season when none of my students are in book 3, and I will need to review what I know in book 3 for myself. So I can only imagine how difficult it will be for a child to recall his or her learned repertoire when there's inconsistent review at home. Fourth thing that I ask my parents to know about helping the child at home is to arrange to attend regular concert performances or put on concerts in the home or community. The parents could also be sure to participate in studio performances and activities in the community, such as playing at nursing or retirement homes, local libraries, special benefits. My kiddos and I went and played at our local grocery store one time to celebrate a special arts event that was happening in the community. We had a ball walking all the way around the produce section, and everyone just cracked up watching the little kids playing among the lettuce heads. I also have a student whose family arranges a home concert every semester that involves several other students and special guests. She makes a very big effort to make sure she has a recital per semester. We've talked about my 8 top things so far. My 9th top thing that I want studio parents to know is how to help the child at lessons. And probably the most important thing to help a child at his or her lessons is to actually go to lessons. I know you're probably giggling, I said this, but sometimes it needs to be said aloud. If a parent wants the child to experience lessons, then the parent needs to take the child to lessons. Even if everyone's having an off day, it's still better to make the effort to go than it is to skip that day. And why do I say this? Because of the inertia problem. You remember what inertia is, right? A body in motion tends to stay in motion, or if you say it in the reverse, a body at rest tends to stay at rest unless another force is acted upon it. And so what does this mean? And it means that if you're sitting down, it's harder to get you out of the chair. And it means that if you're moving around, it's harder to get you to stop and settle down. So how does this apply to attending lessons? Well, if you're on a roll, that is, you're practicing at home and attending lessons regularly, then if you were to skip lessons, you have interrupted the flow. You were ready for a lesson, I'm assuming, and now you have to keep repeating the material you were ready to play for your lesson. So what usually happens? Parents and students stop practicing for a few days. Oh, I know that stuff already, they think. And then they figure, oh, I have another week to be ready. So they stop. That's maybe not the best strategy. But if the parent had gone to the lesson, they might have been able to keep going. Even if the parent has had a poor week of practice, it's still better to go to a lesson to get the motivation back up and running. It's like a shot in the arm, so to speak. And the most important reason for going to a lesson is the message that this action will give to the child. If the parent makes the effort to attend lessons, this signals to the child that something important is happening. This is a good role model for behavior for the child. Other things I want parents to know in the category of helping the child at lessons are that it helps if you prepare the child for his or her lesson while you're driving to the lesson. You can set this up really easy. Set up that pleasant environment for teaching by helping the child recall what things were practiced and to encourage the child's enthusiasm for showing the teacher what things the child worked hard on during the week to learn and improve. In fact, I actually start most lessons by asking the student if there's something that they would like to show me, because usually there's at least one thing that they're very excited to show me. It also helps if parents would follow through with the lesson routine during the home practices. If they would just do what I did in the order that I did it, it helps to set up that same routine at home and maybe sail through any potential problems. I ask that parents refrain from being the teacher during lessons and just sit and observe and take notes. It's helpful for the child not to have someone answering all the questions for him or her at the lessons. So I'd like to let the child stay focused on the teacher, having them stay focused on me and the teaching situation that we're in. And I would prefer that my parents just observe and note what's happening and how things are being done during the lessons. I ask that the parents let the child make mistakes during the lesson without scolding them. And please, without making those noises that parents do. You know, they roll their eyes, you know, none of that. If things happen, I want the parent to just merely note them and make plans to address them at a later time at home. You can always practice something a little harder if you see that things are not quite working the way you thought they would at a lesson. I want my studio parents to pay attention during the lesson and not be distracted by like email and text messages or other electronic activities. I just want parents to stay engaged so that the child feels that the parent is really interested. I ask parents to participate sometimes in the lesson when I ask them, and it's really disheartening to then look over to involve the parent in what's happening in the lesson and find that they have emptied out their purse and they are balancing their checkbook. Let's not do that. I ask parents to bring a notebook and take notes during the lesson. I want parents to help the child by keeping a record of the important teaching points that the teacher's making during the lesson and to make notes of how to practice and teach these same points at home. I'll go into a much more depth into how to do that in another episode. I want parents to be at least aware of the possible distractions from siblings or other youngsters or visitors to the lesson. The child will do better at the lesson if the child is the center of attention and there are no things that take away from that. Of course, when we have young siblings that are tiny little babies, sometimes there are no other arrangements, and sometimes this doesn't always work. But we try to make sure that we have the situation so it's going to be conducive to a good learning for the child. And I also ask parents not to make comparisons with other students or parents, because one parent's situation is quite unique compared to another, and comparisons are going to be unfair since we don't have all the information necessary to make a good judgment about what we observe. The Suzuki method is definitely about cooperation rather than competition. So I ask parents to avoid falling into that comparison trap. I ask parents to measure the child's progress by how the child's skills are being developed, not by how many songs the child can check off in a season. Okay, that's 9 of my top 10 things that I want studio parents to know. And the last and 10th thing on my top 10 list is how to help the child at group classes. Group classes are fun. My students really enjoy spending time with other students in group activities, and they're often very upset if their parent forgets to take them to group class. So here are my top things that I think are important about helping a child at group classes. I ask parents to attend classes regularly because group classes help build motivation and enthusiasm. Children learn social and leadership skills, as well as how to cooperate with the teacher and other students. If a parent and child are having trouble getting the child to practice, sometimes group class may be just the thing to spur both of them to renew their enthusiasm for practice. I ask parents to come early enough that they can have the instrument tuned, they can take care of bathroom needs, and then they can get organized so that the class can actually begin on time. I ask parents to be mindful about bringing siblings if they're going to be a major distraction to the class. Although, if siblings are able to, I often try to involve them in several of the class activities. I keep several box violins and stick bows around and lots of other things that we do with puppets or rhythm. I'm perfectly welcoming to siblings to come join us in these activities if they would like to. And sometimes they wander in and wander out of the class, but that's okay. I ask parents to stick around during portions of the class in which their child might not be participating because group classes are a really great way to preview pieces to be learned and also to review songs that the child has learned before. Sometimes I'll have a student who will stick around in the class even when their portion of the class is finished because they want to sit and try to copy the fingers of the students playing songs that they don't yet know. I usually try to encourage them to maybe copy the bowing because that's a little easier to follow along with. But I have at least one little boy who's very insistent that he wants to sit there and watch the fingers. And you can learn quite a lot from watching another student in a group class. Also, because classes are fun when everyone remembers the songs they've learned before, it's important that the parent include review at home on a regular basis so that the child has an easier time to participate during classes. Nothing bogs down a child's enthusiasm for group class or practice or anything else if they don't remember any of the pieces that they've learned before. If the child is shy or hesitant, I ask parents not to force them to participate and don't try to trick them into joining the group. It doesn't work anyway. Children see right through those ruses. So if necessary, it helps the child just to have the parent come into the group class area and participate themselves if the student won't come in the class. And what we find is that usually the parent's presence in the class helps the child feel more comfortable about joining in the fun. Sometimes students just need to see that activities are safe before they feel comfortable about trying them. Remember, just because a student's not actually doing an activity does not mean that they are not watching and listening and therefore learning anyway. I've heard very interesting stories of students who have observed group classes for months without participating, only to join in one day and perform every activity they had seen during this observation period. So watching and listening are very powerful ways to learn. I ask parents to save visiting with other parents for later. I prefer that parents participate or at least pay attention to what their children are learning and doing. Many group activities are really fun and can easily be duplicated at home. So now's the time for parents to note what things the child enjoyed the most and what things the child would benefit from additional practice at home. I remember one particularly funny group class when we were doing things in the classroom, and on the edge where the waiting area was, the parents started getting involved in a discussion that started getting louder and louder and louder. It finally was so loud that it distracted the kids entirely. So we just turned around and looked at them, and we just stood there. I think we stood there for 20 seconds looking at this very noisy, rowdy bunch of parents on the sofas until the parents finally looked at us, and then we all took our fingers to our lips and went, "Shh." It was very funny because the parents were completely oblivious to the noise that they were making. So anyway, I asked parents to, you know, don't do that if they can help it. I asked parents to show interest in what others are doing, but refrain from comparing what their child does with what other children do. I heard someone once say that a competitive child is happy when he wins and a cooperative child is happy when he does his very best. I think a cooperative child is more desirable than a competitive one. Don't you agree? Parents can help the child recall what occurred during group classes by talking about the class on the drive home. Those little opportunities to review what activities occurred are very helpful to a child's recall. So those are the top 10 things that I want my Suzuki parents to know and understand. It was a very lengthy list, I know. So perhaps it would help if I summarize the list of 10 things. Number one, I want my parents to know what the Suzuki method is, what its basic features are. And I covered that in great depth in podcast episode 1. Second thing is I want my parents to understand the 6 foundational philosophy points of the Suzuki method. And I covered that in episode 2. Number 3. I want my parents to know what the Suzuki triangle relationship is. Number 4, I want my parents to understand the importance of daily listening, and I covered that in great depth in podcast episode 3. Number 5, I want parents to understand the importance of daily practice and to actually do that. Number 6, I want my parents to recognize and understand the personality types, the traits of the parent and the child, and how these traits can impact the parenting relationship and the teaching situation. Number 7, I want my parents to recognize different parenting styles and to focus on improving the parent's parenting style in order to build a better home parenting relationship with the child. Number 8, I want parents to understand how they are to practice at home, and that they are to be involved in the practice at home. Number 9, I want parents to have the tools how to help the child at lessons. And number 10, I want parents to understand how to help their child at group classes. I hope you found this list helpful to give you a basic understanding of the main things that I think a Suzuki parent should recognize and understand about their relationship to the child, to the teacher, and to Suzuki music education journey. And if you think about it further, many of these things are helpful to know about in general about many topics. The more that we are engaged with our children in many of these areas, the better our relationship with our children will be in the home and elsewhere, don't you think? I hope that you will let me know what other things you think are important for a Suzuki parent to know, whether you are a Suzuki teacher or another parent who's had some experience that you'd like to share with our community. If you'd like to leave me a voicemail comment on my voicemail, you can call 512-537-6356 and leave me a message. And I might be able to include that in some of my next episodes. I am particularly interested in any ideas that you use in your studio or at home to make your child's practices and learning more fun and engaging. If you'd like to send me an email instead, you can reach me at paulabirdviolin@gmail.com. And you can find my Facebook page under Teach Suzuki. I'm also on Twitter as @PaulaEBird. And I do Instagram on occasion as Paula_Bird_Violin. And if you like this podcast and find it helpful, it would really help me if you would go to iTunes and subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already done so. And it would really be nice if you could leave me a review if you have the time. I'd really appreciate that. For more information about any of the podcast episodes I've mentioned and the show notes to this podcast episode, go to the podcast website, teachsuzuki.com. For even more information about blog articles, you can find a lot of useful information and articles on my blog at teachsuzuki.blogspot.com. And until next time, happy practicing! This is Paula Bird signing off from the Teach Suzuki podcast, where we talk about how to change our world, one child, one family, and one community at a time.